Wow, what a night. What a program. Graham Hancock with us. His book, Magicians of the Gods. Let me tell you, folks, it's a great read. And don't forget, he may be coming to a city near you. So go to his website, which is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back. Graham Hancock with us. We'll take phone calls with Graham next hour, by the way. Some of you are calling now. No need to. Just wait. Just wait. Graham, paint us a picture. If an object 30 kilometers long hits us, what do we see? What impact do we have? What happens to the planet?
Effectively, if we were to have an impact with that 30 kilometer object, it would sterilize this planet. It would be the end of life on this planet. We have to pray that that never happens. And more than pray, we have to do something about it to ensure that it never happens. It would be the end of the world. A 30-kilometer asteroid hitting the Earth would
Jeez.
End life.
No matter where it hits.
No matter where it hits. It would be a horrendous global cataclysm, and it's most unlikely that certainly the higher life forms on this planet would survive it. Bacteria would get through. Viruses would get through. Maybe some of the insects would get through. The slate would be wiped pretty clean, and a new period of evolution would begin. We've seen this in the past.
It's happened before. Yeah,
it's happened before, and every time after it happens, the old world is gone, and a new world comes into play. The 10-kilometer object that resulted in the extinction of the dinosaurs was really bad. It was a very, very bad event.
And that's the one that hit in the Yucatan, right?
Yeah, the crater was eventually discovered. Interestingly, I was talking about the Younger Dryas and the evidence initially being mainly these impact proxies like nanodiamonds and carbon spherules and melt glass. Exactly the same impact proxies were found for what's called the KT event at the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary 65 million years ago, which is the event that destroyed the dinosaurs. And initially, the scientists Lewis and Walter Alvarez, who proposed a cosmic impact as the cause of the dinosaur extinctions, were ridiculed by their colleagues. But when they were able to produce the crater, then the criticism stopped. And we've known now for many decades that it was a cosmic impact that destroyed and wiped out the dinosaurs. Now, and it changed the world. What happened to the dinosaurs after that? Their line continued. You know, we have chickens today. Mm-hmm. Dinosaurs turned into chickens, basically.
That's right. Alligators, we have them. Birds, yeah. We have them.
Yeah. The dinosaurs devolved. They didn't vanish completely, but they devolved into other species, and you know the chicken is an example. At the same time, there was a little creature that looked a bit like a shrew that was living in trees. That little creature suddenly was able to come out into the light. Now that all these big creatures were gone, its course was set for development, and that creature is the ancestor of all of us. That was the beginning of the mammalian line. That ended ultimately in human beings.
Huh.
So the sweeping away of the dinosaurs opened the road to the new world that became the world that we inhabit and live in today. And that's something like that would happen if we hit a 30-kilometer object. It would sweep us away. It would take the Earth back to a very basic stage, and then life would start to diversify again, and new species would emerge, and we would be forgotten and gone.
How
but
fast?
The thing is, it just doesn't have to happen. That's what I keep saying.
Yeah.
I don't want people out there to get a sense of despair or hopelessness. This is a problem we can solve, but it takes the will and it takes the attention.
How fast would we perish? Would it be instant or over months?
No, it would be pretty much instant. You would have a global firestorm. The entire Earth would be on fire.
I mean, would we have a chance to hug our loved ones goodbye, or it's just bang, you're gone?
There might be hours, depending on where you were on the planet and depending on where the impact was. There might be hours,
but
not much more than that.
All communication would go down probably instantly.
Instantly, yeah. We would lose all communication.
So would we, Graham, let's assume the object hit Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Would we on this side of the planet, because if communications are gone, we're not able to text message, social media collapses, these radio shows, we're gone. But would we know, how would somebody know here that something like that happened?
Because the skies would be full of boiling ash and soot and debris, huge quantities
All right.
of mud and dust would be lofted into the upper atmosphere. The earth would go dark, a swirling cloud of darkness. The ground would shake. Volcanoes would go off all around the planet.
Oh, my gosh.
Seismic plates would shift apart. The effect of that impact smacking into the planet at 70,000 miles an hour, a 30-kilometer-wide object, would be absolutely cataclysmic.
Would buildings begin collapsing and things like that?
Of course, yes, yes. Our cities would go down like ninepins. And you know, you talked about how long would we survive this. Well, right now in our cities, we have a two-day supply of food.
That's right.
Just in time. That's the policy. Food is brought into our cities, and there's a two-day backup, and that's it. So our cities, even if people were not immediately knocked out by the effect of the impact, which I believe they would be, our cities would become a kind of Walking Dead scenario with a complete collapse of social order.
There'd be no running water.
There'd be no running water. There'd be no food. And, you know, the other thing is that none of us, or very few of us in the Western world, some people are making the effort to learn, but very few of us in the Western and the technological world actually know how to survive. We don't really have survival skills.
We can't.
This is one of both the strengths and the weaknesses of our civilization. Our civilization is highly specialized. It's a highly specialized civilization. Every one of us is good at something, but we're not very good at other things. And we rely on others to provide us with their knowledge and this cooperation, this closely interlinked cooperation of specialists produces the success of our society. But the downside of that is that we only know how to do that one thing as individuals. And if you break apart the social links that provide the support structure, then we're left helpless with very, very little that we can do. No, if the impact were with a 30-kilometer object is truly an apocalyptic scenario. But if the impact were with smaller objects, say of the order of 1 or 2 kilometers, several of them that hit the Earth 12,800 mm-hmm. years ago, then humanity would not be wiped out. There would be survivors. And I would suggest that those of us who survived in the cities of the technological West would not last long, because we do not have survival skills.
No.
And we would be so demoralized and so shocked, having lived such a comfortable life for so long and never needed to really lift a finger to survive. I think there would be a massive psychological collapse on top of everything else. But who would survive it would be the hunter-gatherers. The hunter-gatherers of the Amazon Basin, for example, or the hunter-gatherers of the Kalahari Desert Southern Africa. These are people who have really highly developed survival skills. They know how to live off the land. A disaster caused by multiple impacts of 1 or 2 kilometer objects would leave such people, the hunter-gatherers of our planet, pretty much untouched as long as it didn't hit the exact area where they were living. They would survive the disaster, and they would be the ones who would carry the story of humanity forward. And it haunts me, the thought that 10,000 years from now, the descendants of those hunter-gatherers might preserve a memory of a time when an almost magical mm-hmm. civilization existed upon Earth, which could actually fly through the skies and even send people to the moon. We could speak to one another on the other side of the planet, but we became arrogant, the myths might say. We became cruel, we became careless, we became obsessed with material things. We ceased to bear our prosperity with moderation, and we were punished by the universe.
What a great story.
And that lost civilization, most unfortunately, would be us. We would be that lost civilization, remembered by the survivors, by the descendants of the hunter-gatherer peoples who survived the cataclysm. And that's what I think happened 12,800 years ago, that those who survived were primarily the hunter-gatherers, who did indeed exist in the world then, as they exist today.
History does indeed repeat itself, Graham, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, history repeats itself. There are patterns and themes that occur again and again in history. And I'm reminded of that biblical passage about the meek inheriting the earth. Would not be the proud and the arrogant so puffed up with pride in our technological achievements. It would not be our civilization that inherits the earth. It would be the simple people, the hunter-gatherers, the meek of the world, who inherited and carried the mantle of humanity forward.
And you say there's this possibility that we might be able to beat this. What would that be, like blowing up a comet with a nuke? Would that
actually? There's about 10 different technologies that are already extant, which could be used to avert this threat. You don't want to go blowing space rocks up.
You make more fragments, right?
You make more fragments. Instead of getting the single bullet, you get the scatter gun, but it still kills you. That's not the ideal way to go. What you want to do is to really study the orbit of these objects, and then just give them a little gentle shove.
A little push, a nudge.
A little push out there in zero gravity. Just mount a little power source on those things and just shove them a little bit. That's all you need. You just need a slight shove to put them into a different orbit, which no longer crosses and threatens our orbit. Another way to do it is to change what is called the albedo of these objects, the reflectivity of light. Believe it or not, by doing that, that would also alter their course. There's even strategies to attach something like sails to these things that catch the solar wind and move them along. A lot of thought has been put into this, but what's needed now is the investment and the attention. This is something that our civilization has the resources to do, it has the science to do, it certainly has the money to do, but we need to choose to do it.
Why aren't we doing it?
I think that...
They just don't think we're going to get hit.
I'm not sure if it's even that. It's unfortunately the case. There's a sense in which modern technological society is, in fact, clinically insane. Think about it. Think about it. We're willfully destroying our rainforests, cutting out the lungs of the planet. We're polluting our oceans and our beautiful landscapes, turning them into heaps of poisonous rubble. We've spread a cloud of ideology around the world, of fear and hatred and suspicion, dividing us from one another, forgetting that we are all one human family, and that our purpose here on Earth, more than anything else, is to give and receive love. We are diverted into hatred and fear and suspicion instead, deliberately manipulated and churned up by politicians around the world for their own selfish self-interest. All of that is a sign of a society that has gone completely insane. Actually, only an insane society would develop nuclear weapons in the first place, which are capable of killing millions. It takes a psychopathic frame of mind.
And they don't stop.
Willing to do that. And they don't stop. No, they go on, and they don't want ever bigger budgets to create ever more threatening scenarios. And meanwhile, the universe goes on around us, and the Earth is, in fact, in a very hazardous place. And we have got our eye completely off the ball. We need to put it back on the ball. And what I see in this is actually hope for humanity, that here is a common enemy that we can all unite to defeat. And it would be a grand project of the human race to make sure that the Earth is never again hit by the kind of objects that destroyed a civilization 12,800 years ago.
Well, back a couple of years ago, we all witnessed this incredible meteor that blew up over the skies of Russia.
Exactly.
That was just a glimpse of what could happen.
Exactly. And only very recently, there was this comet, that whizzed by between the Earth and the Moon. At Halloween, in fact.
That's
passed
right.
Between the Earth and the Moon on the 31st of October.
Pretty done. 300,000 miles, I think.
Sorry?
300,000 miles.
Something like that, which is a good, safe distance. It's a close pass in cosmic terms,
yeah.
but it's a good, safe distance. The point is, however, that object was half a kilometer in diameter, and it wasn't discovered by NASA until the 10th of October, just 20 days before it passed us very closely. And what this should tell us is that NASA actually has absolutely no idea how many potentially hazardous objects there are out there. The ones they have spotted so far don't look like they're going to hit us in the next 100 years. But it's the ones they haven't spotted that we need to concern ourselves about. And that example, just weeks ago, makes that point very clear. They only saw this thing on the 10th of October. They never knew it was there before. And the calculations indicate that there's hundreds of thousands of objects out there like that, which have not been spotted and tracked yet. So this should be a priority of a sane species. If we were sane rather than clinically insane, we would do something about this. And the fact that we don't do something about it, that we're negligent, and that we instead allow this horrible atmosphere of hatred that is infusing the world at the moment to develop, we are clearly completely nuts.
1,200 people injured in that asteroid over Russia, Graham. 1,200
yeah,
people.
I know. Now, let me tell you about another asteroid over Russia. Except it wasn't an asteroid, it was a fragment of the same comet that hit the Earth 12,800 years ago. And that happened in 1908.
Tunguska.
Tunguska, the Tunguska incident. It wasn't even a big fragment, it was only about 100 meters in diameter. And it didn't even hit the ground. It exploded in the air at an altitude of 5 or 6 kilometers. But that little object exploding in the air at 5 or 6 kilometers above the ground flattened 80 million trees across an area of 2,000 square kilometers, an area about the size of the city of London in England.
Was that populated at all, or?
No, it was miraculously an almost completely uninhabited area of Siberia.
If that blew up over Moscow, it would have been obliterated.
Would be gone.
Gone.
Would
yeah.
be completely gone. Any city that had happened over would have been wiped from the face of the earth. And that was an object out of the Taurid meteor stream. That event happened on the 30th of June 1908 at the heart of one of the two passages through the Taurid meteor stream that our planet makes every year. And that was the June passage, and it was an object out of what are called the Beta Taurids.
I've got to tell you, Graham, it's not a matter of when or if it's going to happen.
Yes, we are in a tricky situation, but again, I want to come back to the positive. It's a tricky situation we can do something about. We just need to change our ways. We need to change our ways and focus on what really matters rather than on the ultimately meaningless pursuits of warfare that have dominated our concerns for so long.
Well, you know, it's going to take a mini explosion over a city killing 25,000 people.
Then people will get the message.
Then they'll get the message.
It's a very painful way to receive the message,
yeah,
and particularly painful since it's avoidable. But that message would get home, and people would realize what
that's what's going to happen. Or a tsunami that wipes out coastal cities or something like
that. You put one of these objects in an ocean, and you have got the tsunami of all tsunamis.
And would it be a tsunami both ways, or would it just go in one direction?
No, it would be both ways. Just like you drop a big rock in.
And out it goes. Bubble.
And out it goes in all directions, yeah. The ripples spread in all directions.
Oh, jeez. Give us your website, Graham, would you please?
GrahamHancock.com, www.GrahamHancock.com. And there's lots of material about magicians of the gods there. There's a whole page on magicians. And thank you for pointing out that I'm also speaking all across the United States. And on the Talks event page, we have a list of my events. Now, some of the places I'm speaking, such as Seattle and Portland, aren't yet on that page. I'm going to be in Seattle on the 7th. Of December and in Portland on the 8th of December, but within 3 or 4 days we'll have them up on the page.
This is a huge book, by the way. You just did a great job.
Thank you. In a sense, it's been brewing for 20 years.
Hold on, Graham. Hold on for a sec. We're going to hit the break. We'll come back and talk more about this. I want to know about the title, Magicians of the Gods, and what that means. We're going to come back in a moment with Graham Hancock. Next hour, his final hour, we'll take phone calls. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Our dear friend Graham Hancock with us, his book, Magicians of the Gods. Tell us about the title, Graham.
I will. Just before I do, I have a message to pass on to you.
Sure.
And that message is from Patrick and Kadena from the Conspiracy Culture
Book. Oh, I love Patrick. Great guy.
In Toronto. You were kindly mentioning my events in the United States, and I'm speaking all over the United States during November and early December, but I'm also going to Canada, and I'll be speaking in Vancouver and in Toronto, and I'm speaking at the Conspiracy Culture Bookstore.
That's where
Toronto,
he is. He
on the 13th of December.
Yep, he helps sponsors our live stage events in Toronto.
Yes,
and has a great bookstore. I mean,
I'm really looking forward to going there.
Cool. First time for you?
Yeah, first time.
Oh, you really enjoy it.
Absolutely. So that's up on the website as well, and all my events on the Talks events page of the website. Now, Magicians of the Gods. Why did I call it?
Love that title.
Yeah. Why did I call it Magicians of the Gods? Well, there is a tradition in Mesopotamia, in ancient Sumer, of a being who was known as Uanadapa, often written as Oannes, a bearded figure, but who had some kind of amphibious quality. He was said to have emerged from the waters of the ocean in a time of turmoil when humanity had fallen to a very barbaric state, and he taught the gifts of civilization to humanity. And he was accompanied by seven sages, seven apkalu, they're called. And that word, these sages are described again and again as magicians. They are sorcerers. They are the possessors of powerful magic and knowledge, and which they deploy in their mission. And their mission is to bring civilization back to the world. And this story is very strong in ancient Sumer, but it's found all around the world. There are seven sages in ancient India, for example. There are seven sages of Easter Island. This notion of the seven sages is a truly universal theme, and wherever we find them, we find that they are attributed with magical powers, hence Magicians of the Gods.
Of everything you studied, everything you've looked at, what do you find to be the most baffling? Is it the two calamities?
No, the two calamities are part of the natural process of the universe. This is this is in itself not so astonishing. What's astonishing is the fact that the evidence for this very recent cataclysm has been not been known for so long, that it's really only in the last 7 or 8 years that this evidence has come out. And it's come out mainly in highly specialized scientific journals, so that the general public are not really aware of this new science to any great depth at all. And that's been one of my objectives in Magicians of the Gods, is to summarize this science in an easy and readable way, which brings forth the impact of this science and what it means for us and for our history. The other astonishing things concern the nature of the archaeological sites that we're finding, and the bizarre explanations that archaeologists come up with to try to account for them. Göbekli Tepe in Turkey is a classic example. And when you look at the map, you'll see that Göbekli Tepe lies between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Indeed, it is part of ancient Mesopotamia. What's really baffling about the archaeological response to Göbekli Tepe is this. It's important to be clear that archaeologists work with a timeline of history, and they see it as a smooth process of continuous evolution from primitive cavemen, you know, to highly technological modern world. Mm-hmm. And they don't account for any global cataclysm within that process. First we were hunter-gatherers, then we entered the Mesolithic, slightly more sophisticated stone aspect of the Stone Age, then the Neolithic. At the same time we developed agriculture, started about 11,000 plus years ago, the first signs of agriculture, and then we go on from there and we get the first true cities being built about 5,000 or 6,000 years ago, and the story continues from there. And this is the timeline of history that we are given by archaeologists. Within that timeline, there is no place for a civilization that was capable of creating a site like Göbekli Tepe 12,000 or 11,600 years ago. Our ancestors at that time are supposed to have been entirely hunter-gatherers. They are not supposed to have had the organizational skills to put together a site that's 50 times bigger than Stonehenge. This is an area without water, by the way, Göbekli Tepe. It's almost a desert area. You would have had to have had a workforce of hundreds there. They would have had to have been organized and disciplined. They'd have had to have been fed and watered. You would need a flow of megaliths from the quarry to the site. You would have need people who were skilled in raising and erecting these 20-ton, in some cases 50-ton, megaliths at Göbekli Tepe. You would have needed astronomers, because the site contains the world's first perfectly north-south aligned building, as accurately aligned as the Great Pyramid of Giza. And you can't do that without astronomy. And all of this is supposed to have happened, if we're to believe the mainstream archaeologists, a group of hunter-gatherers woke up one morning with a sudden inspiration. They were suddenly, miraculously equipped with the knowledge to create this gigantic megalithic site, which has no precedent and no background and just comes out of nowhere. And at the same time, they invented, this is what Klaus Schmidt, the discoverer of Göbekli Tepe, actually told me, they invented agriculture, because it's exactly at that moment when Göbekli Tepe is made that agriculture starts to spread in eastern Turkey and eventually spreads around the world. Now, this to me is just a lunatic explanation that archaeologists come up with. Of course, there has to be a background to Göbekli Tepe. You don't get that level of stoneworking skill overnight. It's a work of hundreds or thousands of years of acquiring that knowledge. So where is that all that information? What Göbekli Tepe looks like to me is not a radically inspired group of hunter-gatherers who wake up one morning suddenly equipped with the ability to create megalithic architecture and invent agriculture. What it looks like to me is a transfer of technology. The survivors of the lost civilization, some of them, settled in eastern Turkey. And there they set about a project to rebuild their former world
right,
of the gods.
As much as they could.
As much as they could. And they created Göbekli Tepe as a center of innovation. And they taught the local inhabitants how to do it. And they taught them agriculture. And that's why we see agriculture suddenly appearing. And to me, it's just astonishing that archaeologists are so wedded to their old model of history, a model that does not take into account the Younger Dryas cataclysm, that they are prepared to go to such lengths to explain away this truly anomalous and puzzling evidence.
Is there anything more to Göbekli Tepe, or have they uncovered everything?
Oh, no. Most of it's still under the ground.
Really?
Yeah. Probably 80 to 90% of it is still under
the
ground.
Oh, my. I didn't know that.
Hundreds and hundreds of megalithic pillars deeply buried under the ground have been imaged with ground-penetrating radar.
What do you think the purpose of that structure might have been?
I think the purpose of that structure was a civilizing exercise. It became a center of innovation. It was, if you like, the ancient university. It was where the initiates were brought and instructed and taught how to deliver.
A focal point.
A focal point. And it was a project that mobilized and galvanized the local population. And I think that was part of the function of the project was to do that. And so they could be taught, and then we see the benefits developing. Because it's truly from there that the timeline of what we think of as the origin of civilization begins. It starts right there, 11,600 years ago, immediately after what we now know was an extinction-level global cataclysm, which is not being taken into account of the models of the origins of civilization that historians and archaeologists present us with.
Graham, did you know Zahi Hawass?
I know Zahi very well, and I had
maybe too well, right?
Yeah, I've known him for years, and we had an encounter in April this year in Giza. It had been previewed actually for a year. There was going to be a great debate between Zahi Hawass and myself. I was going to debate the case for the lost civilization, the alternative view of history, and he was going to debate the case for the mainstream view. The idea was that we'd each give a presentation. I would give a presentation, and then Zahi would give his presentation, and then we would enter into debate and discussion and involve the audience as well. But Zahi walked into the room when I was setting up my slides, because I was the first person to give the presentation, so I was going to do my PowerPoint first. And I was setting up my PowerPoint show and just focusing to make sure that the images were sharp when Zahi and his entourage walked in. And he took one look at the image on the screen, which was a photograph of my friend Robert Bovall, the originator of the Orion.
And he does not like Robert at all.
He does not like Robert. I think Zahi and Robert Bovall have got past lives together.
Yes.
I think they go back thousands of years. This intense animosity between these two men is more than can be.
Maybe Bovall was the pharaoh and Zahi was one of the builders. Who knows?
I think that's a really good speculation. And so I showed Robert's picture and I showed the Orion correlation, and Zahi immediately furiously exploded. How dare you? You cannot talk about this man. You cannot talk about this so-called Orion correlation. It has been proved to be incorrect. And he said, if you're going to talk about that, I'm not going to talk to you. And I said, but what am I supposed to do? I'm here to represent the alternative point of view. I have to represent it properly. I can't leave Robert Bavar and the Orion correlation out of this. But Zahi stormed out, and his final conclusion was that he would give his talk. He sat outside sulking for an hour and a half while I gave my talk. Then he then came in and gave his talk. Now, two good things happened. During his explosion, in those first minutes when I was setting up my presentation, one member of the audience had arrived early and filmed about 2.5 minutes of that confrontation between Zahi and I.
I think it's on YouTube now.
And it's on YouTube, and it went viral because Zahi, Zahi has a public image of this very lovable, funny guy who can sometimes lose his temper, but basically he's a jokey sort of fellow.
He's lucky he's not in jail, Graham.
Yeah, he's very lucky. But what he showed was the teeth behind the smile. We saw the real Zahi, the explosive, furiously angry, arrogant, bullying Zahi came across in that video clip. And then, secondly, when he gave his presentation, a member of the audience asked him what were his views on Göbekli Tepe and did it change his views of the origins of civilization in Egypt. And amazingly, Zahi Hawass claimed to know absolutely nothing about Göbekli Tepe,
the
world's most important archaeological site. So the member of the audience said, well, perhaps Graham Hancock could tell you about it. And I said, well, if Zahi had actually bothered to listen to my presentation, he would know all about it now. And then I stood up and I gave my point of view. And that was the only real debate we had. And that is also up on YouTube. In fact, if you go to my website, to the articles page on my website, scroll down about a dozen lines and you'll come to it. I think it was the 14th of April.
He wants that antiquities job back, doesn't he?
Yes, I think he does. I mean, Zahi's closely connected to the military in Egypt, and his star rises and falls with the military. So during the Morsi episode, Zahi fell from favor.
Right.
And in fact, he was charged with various offenses involving fraud and
well, they thought he sold off artifacts and things.
Apparently.
Right?
And he was sentenced to a year in prison. But then there was the coup, and the military took over again, Sisi in power. And the first thing that the new military government did was, without explanation, was to cancel Zahi's conviction.
He knew somebody. He lucked out there.
It looks like it. And he remains a very powerful player in Egypt to this day. I get the sense that he's biding his time, waiting for things to stabilize.
Graham, the technology that was there prior to the first, let's say, comet hit.
Yeah.
In your opinion, how elaborate might it have been? I mean, I've speculated that maybe they got to the moon. What do you think?
I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't rule it out, because there are so many anomalies concerning the moon and indeed concerning the planet Mars. But that's not my sense of the nature of this civilization. This was a highly developed, if you like, mental and psychic culture. It was focused upon the powers of the human mind and much less focused than we are upon physical technologies. Nevertheless, they had achieved a high level of development, the ability to explore and map the world with incredibly accurate longitudes and latitudes, is something that our civilization couldn't do until the end of the 18th century. So to find that ability more than 12,000 years ago truly rewrites history.
In ancient India texts, of course, they talk about the Brahmanas, flying machines. To me, that means there might have been some incredible technology going on.
It's possible that there was. I have tried to ground Magicians of the Gods in absolutely solid and reliable facts from beginning
pure science
to end. Yeah, but hopefully written in a readable and engaging way. First and foremost, I am a writer, but I'm a writer in a very controversial field, and I believe that there are extremely important arguments to be put forward here. We have to consider again completely our notions of the origins of human civilization. And I feel that I serve that cause better by producing a book that is solidly grounded in science and that doesn't do too much speculation. There's an argument to win here, and I want to see that argument won, because if it is won, it's going to change the world, if we come to understand that everything we've been told about the origins of our civilization is false, that everything we have based our idea upon ourselves upon is built on foundations of sand, if that's the case, then it causes us to question the existing order of things as well. And in this sense, ancient history is potentially very destabilizing for the powers that be in the existing world. They are heavily invested in the model that we are the apex and pinnacle of creation. And to find that we are just another civilization that could be swept away in an instant would have profound effects on our outlook.
The Great Pyramid of Giza, built by poured rock, dragging these huge blocks. I think they just levitated the stones.
I think they did too. Yeah. I think they did too. And there are accounts of gigantic blocks being raised by priests chanting in unison and creating extraordinary sounds that caused these blocks to rise up into the air. The Great Pyramid is truly an enigma.
It's
an incredible anomaly. And I think that we need to look at it and all of the monuments on the Giza Plateau again, and very, very carefully. Egyptology has a very simplistic account of the monuments of Giza Plateau, the three great pyramids and the megalithic temples and the Sphinx. According to Egyptology, all go back to the epoch of 2500 BC, 4,500 years ago. And they're all the work of the fourth dynasty, Khufu, Khafre, Menkaure, and other such monarchs. In fact, and I've gone into this in the book, when you examine the basis upon which the Egyptological case is made, if you really examine it, you find that it's incredibly flimsy. It's a kind of fairy tale that we're being told by Egyptology. This creates a situation with regard to Giza. There's no doubt the pharaohs were there, and they did a huge amount of work at Giza. But my very strong realization as I've been researching this work is that Giza is a highly nuanced site, that there are aspects of Giza that go back fully 12,500 years. The Great Sphinx and its megalithic temples belong to that period. But there are other aspects that were completed, at least, by the pharaohs, and this is what's caused the confusion in the dating of Giza.
Graham, let's talk some more and also take phone calls next hour. Final hour ahead with Graham Hancock, Magicians of the Gods.